It's Inside Out, the naked truth, coming to you live from Lupin Lodge in the Los Gatos Hills of California, where clothing is optional. But what is the truth, Rochelle?
It's always naked.
It's always naked.
And tonight is the 13th episode of At Home at Lupin with the Striders. And I am Rochelle Alicia Strider.
And I am Errol Strider.
Oh, thank God he knew his name tonight.
Sometimes
we invited you over here tonight for some conversation, a few laughs, spiritual perspectives, and as many surprises as possible. Since only our innocence can truly be surprised, please feel free to bring yours with you.
Our time tonight has been gifted by Go Raw. Wonderful people, 100% raw food that not only tastes good, but is good for you.
Wonderful people, it sounds like we're eating people.
Well, they are. They're delicious. Rob and his dad, Yuri, they were so helpful to us in our move. Not only are they sponsors of our program, but they've just been very personally helpful. So we're glad for them, and so we want to encourage you to go find their products at Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, or even the organic section of Costco.
Or go to GoRaw.com to find out where a Go Raw product can be found in your neighborhood.
And if you want to call us tonight at any point and make some smart aleck remark, then you can call at 888-627-6008. But it better, if not be funny, it better be a good setup for a punchline.
That's right. So we'll say that number again, 888-627-6008.
Okay.
All right. Here we are. So all I've been doing for the last 2 days, Errol, is thinking about the impending birth of our grandchild. And I find myself like I'll wake up sometimes and think, I don't want to get too, I don't want to project too much out there, you know, like, because I don't know who she is yet. I want to feel, you know, like I want to bond with her before I start projecting images on her.
Well, in case you don't know, and we're so happy you're here with us, we expect our granddaughter to arrive in a couple of weeks, right? Mm-hmm. So perhaps the show, not this next one, but the following one or the one after that, will be cooing for most of the show.
Yeah, and we have two babies here at Lupin, two little children, girls who were born about 5 months ago, and they come into my sight every now and then. I get to practice cooing over them and having them laugh and smile at me. And
I thought that's what you're doing with me when you were cooing over me. I thought I was practice.
Well, you are, but that's a lifetime practice. This is just a temporary practice.
Right. And the cooing over me probably requires a lot more practice. That's probably why they give men and women each other as spouses for lots of practice.
To coo.
To coo.
I guess, remember that?
No, I guess I want to say to treat each other with the same treasure, like a treasure in the way we treat babies. I mean, babies are like amazing.
Oh, gosh.
Even their poop smells good. I mean, it's the, well, not quite, but.
Do you remember that the thing is that we all started out as babies? We forget that's who we are. We were babies. I mean, so like babies are not separate from us. Babies are part of who we are.
Were you a happy baby?
I think I was. I think I was a happy baby. I was like the first grandchild in my family, and had a lot of people cool all over me. I mean, I had a unmarried uncle to whom I was like a living doll.
They had like a coup fest, didn't they, at that time for you? It was coup festival. Where people come, some of the great coolers, yodelers, coolers, cooers.
Oh, my God.
They all show up at these.
No, but my uncle, I do remember, you know, like I have many, many pictures of him playing with me, you know, that he would throw me up in the air like I was a football or something. And I laughed and loved it every minute of it. And he had a bunch of guy friends, and I was like the mascot of this group. I must have been, you know, well, I was born and he, but the pictures I have, I guess I was about less than a year old, 8 months, 9 months, just learning to walk.
What's your first memory ever?
I'm trying to think. It's hard to, somehow I remember putting my dad's socks on my hands to play with a dog that he had brought home. And so that the dog wouldn't bite my fingers, but he'd bite my dad's socks. And my dad getting kind of upset because the dog had made holes in all the socks which were on my hands. I remember that. And I don't think I was under two. I was about maybe 18 months. I remember somehow that. I remember that particular thing.
My first memory was like, it was a moment in my geometry class.
Oh, you're going to. I knew you were going to make a joke. I knew you were not going to be serious about this at all.
No, not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of geometry.
We weren't speaking of geometry. We're speaking of our first memory.
Oh. Well, now we're speaking of geometry.
We are now. Yes, we are.
Well, I was reminded the other day of the whole concept of sacred geometry. And for those of you who have tuned in before and been with us, you know that Rochelle and I are anal compulsive about deepening into the imponderables of life.
And imponderables. I love it. I've never heard it described like that.
You know, that which we seek to connect and understand that is utterly non-understandable. But
well, certainly
nevertheless,
not with our finite minds.
No, but I was thinking of this sacred geometry. My good friend Don in Boulder had created this picture of the there's a dot, and then it extends itself, and then they, in turn, form this triangle. And it's like being, and then being, loving being itself, which is over on this side, and the two of them being loving being itself, loving back loving being itself, is so like enormous.
It's so a lot of loving being yourself kind of
that it literally gives birth to a third dimension of being, which is the being of mutuality, which is the being of what is called the Spirit of Truth or the Holy Spirit or the third person of the Trinity. And that is in many ways, it's the inevitable explosion of two all loving beings infinitely in rapture with no place to express it. And so they had to create a whole universe in this spirit presence that sort of supports it.
Well, on the most personal biological level, that's what we do all the time by having babies. We come together, each one person and another person come together and create this third being, which is a composite of all those beings that have been in those two beings forever.
It's true, and the being, so it's always about threesome, isn't it? Like, you know, it's almost like there's always three babies that we're involved with. There's the one, there's the second, and then there's the third. But all of them are so sweet.
Each of these might be and of course.
This is Sinead O'Connor singing Three Babies.
That's a lot. You know, my very good friend of mine has niece who had triplets. That's something else to look upon. I mean, twins, you got two arms, but triplets, how do you pick them up at the same time? You can't. One of them's got to stay in the crib or on the floor.
It's true.
You know?
For all
I was thinking about being a grandma, you know, and I realized, I wrote this thing down, I said, grandparenting is so different from parenting. It's like watching your drama and comedy played by a different cast. And I was thinking, too, that my son, a son of mine, my child, who I have known from conception to now, is going to know another like I know him from conception to now.
Yeah, that'll teach him.
Your mother would always say, I hope you have a child like you whenever you did something that irritated her.
My mother never said that.
My mother did. No, she always did. She said, I hope you have a, well, I never had a girl child, but she was always thinking that I should have a little girl that was as, what is the word, stubborn, maybe not stubborn, but
impossible to sit still.
Impossible to sit still and intent on living my own life out of the box that my parents had created for me, which was, in their mind, safe. The box they'd created was a safe box. I didn't want to live in a safe box.
The child, just implicit in its very existence and in how we regard it, is part of a relationship. There can be no child. It's like I was thinking about that piece that you performed called Today I Am a Child, and mm-hmm. this is about a woman who goes through a difficult period until she finds, quote unquote, the answer, although the character says it wasn't like it was an answer, or it was more like that was missing, was no longer missing. And then she ends it with, you can't be a child without a parent. And that brings up just the whole notion of the parental nature of deity, and to what extent is that metaphor useful or valid. I had one of my spiritual experiences, one of those moments where I felt like there was a breakthrough out of my habitual mental patterns and habits, but I had this experience.
Some people think of it as a breakdown, but nevertheless.
Well, the doctors actually did refer to it that way. But I thought, hey, I'm not wearing white. You guys are the men in white. You know, I've got some color.
So for you, it was a breakthrough.
Yeah, but the actual experience was I was standing on a balcony. I was teaching at the University of Miami. This was like late 60s, and I was standing out on this balcony overlooking the campus, talking to a student. And as I looked out, I had this experience that the air that everywhere was filled with a presence, and it was a personal presence. It wasn't just some ether. It was personal, and it was a presence of a, it felt like a presence of a parent, a father, a parent. And in that moment, I saw that the notion that we make of our God anthropomorphically, like us, I saw it was the reverse, that was the original pattern. Father, mother, offspring is the original pattern, and we are like the reversed anthropomorphic version of that first deity. We are, in other words, that's the prototype, and we're the duplicates of that fundamental nature, which is father, which is parent. And that was a real breakthrough for me.
The two creating the third.
Right. And it reminded me of my own father, of course. And my father was a wonderful man, and I wrote this poem, which I'd like to share about him. It's called Abba, which is kind of like a daddy in, I guess, Aramaic.
And Hebrew.
And Hebrew, Abba. And it goes like this. I kissed my father and held his hand. That should tell you something about me and my theology. For me, father is a fat face, which makes me want to pinch the cheeks of Sid Caesar. Like my father, too funny for reruns even. But my dad cried for me, even though it was for himself. He feared loss as I was being expelled from college. And the marble walls wanted to sweat with my father's tears. He loved me, he did, my old man, in spite of his death and my judgment of his weakness, and that he left this life as a bud and not as a blossom. But I did hold his hand during his late night life in front of the Johnny Carson show, and we laughed where we couldn't talk or grow. And though he wouldn't give me the car to run off after women, he continued to hug me in my thoughts and made God a God who kisses and fondles me and scrumptiously tucks me in bed night after night while I was ripening.
What a lovely testimony to that relationship you had with him.
Yeah.
Yes, it's interesting, you know, when a new being is coming into the world, it is a time of reflection. It's a time of like, what was that like for me as a parent? What was it like for my parents to have me? You know, I didn't think about that too often, and we certainly didn't talk about it when we got older. And they weren't anywhere near here when our children were born. Your mother was far away. My mother and father were far away. They weren't within stopping over to help with the kid distance.
Not exactly.
No. So we were sort of alone, you know, and our son has got a lot of parental support. In that sense, his wife's parents are close by, and her sister is close by, and our son's brother is close by, and we're close by him. So that's a very different scenario than the one we had when we had our children.
It is a different scenario.
I don't know if it's good or bad.
Well,
we had a lot of friends who acted in that support system.
I'm not sure there's a good or bad to it as much as there's a comfortable / easy versus hard, uncomfortable aspect to it, to the degree, because especially if you have three kids, like you said, where's the other arm? And in many ways you do have three kids, because you've got yourself, you've got your child, and you've got your husband, and all three of us are actually children, aren't we?
You, yeah. But you were such a cute kid to go along with the other ones. Here's the big kid, and here's the two little ones.
So how are you all doing out there with regard to your child self? Maybe some of you got an inner child. Not everybody gets one. They hand them out depending upon your luck of the draw. Look, you get an inner child. You don't. Why did I get an inner child? Well, because you haven't really grown up.
You don't need an inner child. You've got an outer child.
I'm an outer child. I am. I'm just a baby. And so I was like a baby when I was still a baby. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what constitutes a grown-up at all? I don't know. But I have a friend who just turned 65, and she said, I think I can consider myself a grown-up.
That reminds me of a story, and it's something. It's a story I tell in our show, Family Baggage. For those of you who don't know, I co-wrote this play, a series of vignettes about family systems and dysfunctionality and alcoholism and abuse and other funny things like that. And at the last scene of the play, I talk about this moment where I was describing, I had a wonderful relationship with a woman in Florida at the time I was awakening to my spirituality, or at least the possibility of this other realm. And I remember I had this moment when she was visiting me, and she had five children, by the way. My first serious relationship came with five children, five boys, already part of the package.
Wow, five boys.
Speaking of baby, yeah, that was my 23 years old. There I was with Anne and her five boys.
Woo. How old was the oldest?
11.
Wow.
And he did not appreciate me.
No, of course not. 11, no, not at all.
But during this moment of with Anne, I don't know what kicked it off, but I had this experience of getting in touch with a lot of resentment and anger I had toward my parents that I had kind of kept buried until that moment. And at that moment, I found myself not just expressing it, but feeling it, and I just burst into tears and sobbed for the longest time. And I remember she held me like a child, cradled me in her arms, and I was released of that because a strange thing happened. After she held me, and it was a long time, it could have been 15 minutes to a half an hour, I got up, I went to the front door of my place, and I looked out, and her twin sons had been playing outside, and they were outside, and I watched them. And I realized in that moment that was the first time I felt like I was a man and was no longer a child like them.
Wow. That's pretty good. Not everybody ever has that kind of experience.
No, I guess not, but I was very fortunate to have that. And maybe you've had an experience like that. But one of the things we got to remember that, you know, our children aren't ours. You know, they're just passing through. And cherish them, be there for them. And
your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. They have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can house their bodies, but not their souls. For their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You can strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. They have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts. You can house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in a place of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You can try to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you. Strive to be like them, but you cannot make them just like you.
Oh, that was wonderful. What was that? Who
was that? Was Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Oh, wow. Did you just take my pen?
Ooh. Thought I could get away with it. She was listening to the music. She was distracted, and there was that pen that I coveted. And that's one of the things that you get to discover when you come into this life is the whole coveting reflex. You know, they kind of outlawed it around Moses' time, or they tried to outlaw it. But I've noticed that that coveting impulse is still very much alive in me. Not as much as it was when I was, well, a child. But you look at those things out there that are so
seductive.
I covet that.
Thou shalt not covet.
So if you're doing any coveting out there, we have a product that we'd like to offer you, which is it's called Anti-Covet. And
Anti-Covet?
Anti-Covet. And you can take it orally. You can sprinkle it in your toilet. You can put
sprinkle
it, in,
it
your,
in your toilet?
Well, because it... Oh,
that's
never
disgusting.
Mind.
I don't want to hear this anymore. Yeah. I think we should stop him.
Anti-covet.
Right here. Anti-covet.
So, yeah, but I think it's good to acknowledge when you are coveting and that it is coveting, and because it's something that can really impede our true gathering of the real stuff of the universe to ourselves. Like,
I mean, you covet because there's a lack.
Or it's just desirable. Yeah, you don't have it.
So you want it. That's what I mean by a lack. You know, something you don't covet what you got.
Not usually.
Because you already got it.
It kind of goes against the definition of the word, doesn't it?
That's right. So you're only coveting that which you don't have. And you believe that if you don't have that, most of the time, that you're less. But if you have it, then you're more. So coveting can lead to total deception.
It can.
And then again, coveting could also lead to building bridges. You know, I covet the knowledge to build a bridge. I covet the bridge itself to get across the stream because the water's running too high. I got to get across it. So is that coveting?
Well, I don't know.
It's a loose definition.
Yeah, it's very loose, very loose. Matter of fact,
are you calling me loose?
I wouldn't. You are a loose woman in your own way. I wouldn't wear it. Let's just say that because it's really loose.
Oh, dear. Oh, it depends. Wearing loose things is kind of fun, actually.
So back to being grandmother and the whole phenomenon of what they say, the lyric in that song, sons and daughters of life longing for itself.
Oh, that's so the lyrics in that song are just lovely.
And there is this life presence longing for itself. I mean, think about the quality of intimacy. Not only do you have the baby that comes out, but you have the way of producing the baby. Let's not forget that.
How can you forget that?
I mean, that's like the universe provides this very tasty experience to make sure it.
Did you know you realize that in more. Many, many societies, that the ardor or the passion or the emotional experience of having of creating a child were not always present? I mean, it was like a man planted his seed because it was. And a woman dutifully received it.
Right.
But didn't go into, like, having a real emotional experience around it. So a lot of babies still to this day, you know, get born out of, not out of a mutual adoration, but out of pure lust or no lust, even just...
Just doing your duty.
Doing your duty, right. And so we're very fortunate, you know, those of us who have given birth or been birthed by people who cared about each other and had a passion for each other and had a closeness and a real understanding. I think to be born out of that union is delightful.
Speaking of delightful, it's
lovely.
It's so listen to this, so okay. Adorable, and I want you to experience this. So imagine that you're looking at this brand new baby. If you've seen one, you've been one, you've heard about them, anyway, and this is what you're feeling and thinking.
A, you're adorable. B, you're so beautiful. C, you're a cutie full of charms. D, you're a darling. And E, you're exciting. And F, you're a feather in my arms. G, you look good to me. H, you're so heavenly. I, you're the one I idolize. J, we're like Jack and Jill. K, you're so kissable. The love light in your eyes. M N O P. I could go on all day. Q R S T. Alphabetically speaking, you're okay. You make my life complete. V means you're very sweet. W X Y Z. It's fun to wander through the alphabet with you to tell you what you mean to me.
A B C D E F G H I
Michelle was lip-syncing the entire song. You know, for those of you who are here, I know you appreciated watching here. And for those of you who are not here, that's what you're missing is seeing my wife lip-sync that song.
The alphabet song.
The alphabet song. And by the way, that's off YouTube. And if that whole version of YouTube is pictures of babies. And it's just, it's really cute. So you got to go there and check it out.
Who sang it?
You know, that's a good question. I'll have to come back and find that. I'm not sure if it was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir or the Russian Chorus Ensemble.
I don't think so.
Robert Shaw Chorale. Anyway, so.
I learned the alphabet singing that song. I really did.
You really did?
Yep. And I know every word of it to this day. I learned it when I was like five.
What words of that song really stand out for you, Rochelle?
It's fun to wander through the alphabet with you, tell you what you mean to me.
That's great. That is so great.
Yeah. It wasn't so long ago, even though it's 75 years, that I was the baby and being cooed over, like we'll be cooing over our grandchild soon. And there's something that we come into life with this innocence, this clean slate, even though people will say, well, you know, we have old souls. But in looking at these infants, they may be old souls, but they're brand new mortals. And as brand new mortals, they're just amazing. Just amazing. I have been baby watching. I can't even, there's so many babies being carried around, that I've become aware of in the last few weeks. And each one has the same attribute.
What's that?
Adorable. A, you're adorable. They are adorable. So I'd like to think that we still have that within us. Our adorability is still present.
Well, they have to balance it out with all that crying and fetching. And it's so interesting. They design the baby, on one hand, to be adorable, and on the other hand, to create such irritating noises that you get up, you'll do things you otherwise wouldn't do for any other human being to stop that noise.
It's a demanding sound, otherwise the baby would not be taken care of. You remember when we were pregnant for the first time, and I was walking around, oh, so we're getting a little baby, da-da-da-da, and you kept saying, yeah, and it's going to poop, and it's going to throw up, and it's going to, and you kept making the picture equal, so to speak, with all the delicious things on one side and all the other stuff on the other side, so I wouldn't get too blown out of proportion about being a mom. And I always thought that was very funny, you know, because I knew that too, but I don't think I could have taken care of all those needs if the child wasn't adorable to me.
Of course not.
I wanted to take care of it.
Well, that's, like I say, that's the way they make them. And they make them tiny, real small, so that they're not too much to have to deal with.
You know, they came out like a big man.
There was another planet where they came out really big, you know, and it was like, George Bernard Shaw wrote this song called Back to Methuselah. Not a song, a play. It's actually a hugely long play, which is performed over three nights. And the first act is at the beginning of time. Then then the second act at night, the play is more current. And then the third night, as far as thought can reach. And at that point, I remember, the scene is that the children are in an egg till they're about 21. In George Bernard Shaw's vision of the future. And then they come out and deal with it. Because I haven't read that play in over 50 years, so I don't remember the details, but no doubt.
Well, there were times when I wanted to put my children in a closet and not let them out till they were 21.
There aren't those times, you know, and they're not infrequent. We just lost a young lady, probably in her early 20s. I was putting up a tent here at Lupin, and I'm not really a camper kind of guy, and so I wasn't doing a very good job of it. And I was like, where does this rod go? How does that thing, what it fit into? Those sort of questions, fundamental questions. Or,
like standing there with two rods in your hand and wondering why.
You know, I feel kind of inept. And this young lady came over, and I remember she had a big smile on her face and a place where she was expecting a new tooth, I guess, because there was none there. Anyway, but she came over and she helped me, and then just about 3 weeks ago, I was trying to do something else. Oh, yeah, I was trying to replace a light bulb in my car battery. And she just, and I couldn't, it was difficult. She just happened to show up at that moment and kind of helped make it happen. And I had these two experiences of her. And then last week we heard that she died.
Boom. 31.
31. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it can be very quick. And our immediate thought was her parents and what they must be feeling to have lost their child. We're not sure what she died from. It was some kind of an infection in her body or something.
Yeah,
we don't really know.
Nobody knows it right now.
Yeah. So.
But birth and death, that's what we are made of.
Precious.
Yeah.
You know, precious time, precious. And that's why we really need to be savoring. I've tried to catch myself in whatever I'm doing more and more these days, I'm trying to make it a habit, is to practice savoring whatever's showing up in the moment. It doesn't really matter what it is. But certainly savoring food. I had this idea for many years, I haven't done it, of the savoring diet, where I don't know if this is, it's you savor every bite. And I suspect if we really did that rather than the compulsive noshing, but even if you nosh, you savor every bite and
You probably eat less.
You probably eat less because what happens to me, when, especially if something takes a lot of chewing, my mouth just gets tired. It's like it kind of drops down because it just gets tired of chewing. Have you come to that place in your life yet where your mouth gets tired of chewing? No, not really. No, I still like to chew away.
Yes, somebody told me today they'd like to live here because there's a lot of hills to walk up and down. They thought they would lose weight, and I said to them, the truth is the only way you're going to lose weight is to eat less.
But walking up and down the hills is helpful. By the way, speaking of eating, so our cook here, Rose, we love Rose, at Lupin Lodge. She's one of the cooks. I'm one of the other cooks, as it turns out. Anyway, so she made this banana bread that was to live for. And I said, I got to have the recipe. And so she gave me the recipe, and I thought, I'm going to make this banana bread. And I started making it. I mixed all the ingredients, and it looked really great. And it was in, and then it came out of the pan and as a muffins, and I took a bite of it, and it was so salty. So bitterly salty.
I saw his face. It was really, really, really disappointing face.
And then it said, well, it said only do a pinch. And then I had to acknowledge that I put, you know, kind of a little small teaspoon in it. But then I was thinking, no, it's really salty. Not just a half teaspoon more salty. It's like, you know, it's like having muffin with your salt. And then I had this idea to see what was in the sugar jar. If it was really sugar, and sure enough, I went over there, and it was salt. And wherever the recipe called for sugar, I just put in like this half a cup of salt. Ergo.
Very salty muffins.
So I kept them inside because it's been raining, but I thought maybe there's some animal, because we live in the woods, and one of the animals might need some salt. So I threw it out today. I'll be interested to see if any of it gets slurped up.
Can't imagine ants liking a lot of salt.
Well, there's a salt-coveting ant colony.
But they're babies, so they're adorable.
Right. And they think it's sugar. That's why they covet the salt. These ants.
Until they taste it.
Until they taste it. And then they get converted. And as a result of their conversion, they become like whole new kinds of species that are like, what happens when an ant goes?
The salt tabernacle singers.
Right. What happens when an ant goes into a cocoon?
Ants don't go into cocoons.
Not anymore.
I don't think they ever went into cocoons.
You know, we have these very sweet renditions of these songs, but for me, I guess my favorite anticipatory of child coming song is going to be, well, this one. And as a man, it really has some power and some passion.
Go ahead and tell me what it is. Make it quick.
Well, I can't tell you so quick. Why don't you drink your coffee?
Is that what you come to tell me?
No, but by the time you drink it, I'll have told you.
Well?
Well, yesterday my head ached, and you asked me if...
Yes.
Well, you see, that's what it is. I'm gonna have a baby.
Julie.
You ain't mad, Billy, are you?
Should you be walking up them stairs?
Sure, Billy.
Here, let me help you.
I'm all right. I'm fine. Just as long as you ain't mad.
Julie.
wonder what he'll think of me. I guess he'll call me the old man. I guess he'll think I can lick every other feller's father. Well, I can. I bet that he'll turn out to be the spitting image of his dad. But he'll have more common sense than his pudding-headed father ever had. I'll teach him to wrestle and dive through a wave when we go in the mornings for our swim. His mother can teach him the way to behave, but she won't make a sissy out of him. Not him, not my boy, not Bill. Bill, my boy Bill, I will see that he's named after me. I will. My boy Bill, he'll be tall and as tough as a tree. Will Bill, like a tree, he'll grow with his head held high and his feet planted firm on the ground. And you won't see nobody dare to try to boss him or toss him around. No pot-bellied, baggy-eyed bully will boss him around. I don't give a hang what he does, as long as he does what he likes. He can sit in his tail or work in a rail with a hammer and spikes. He can ferry a boat in a river or pedal a pack in his back, or work up and down the streets of a town with a whip and a horse and a hack. He can haul a scow along a canal, run a cow around a corral, or maybe bark for a carousel. Of course, it takes talent to do that well. He might be a champ of the heavyweights, or a fellow that sells you glue, or president of the United States. That'd be all right, too. His mother would like that, but he wouldn't be president unless he wanted to be. Not Bill. My boy Bill, he'll be tall and as tough as a tree. Will Bill, like a tree, he'll grow with his head held high and his feet planted firm on the ground. And you won't see nobody dare to try to boss him or toss him around. No fat-bottomed, flabby-faced, pot-bellied, baggy-eyed bully will boss him around. And I'm hanged if he'll marry his boss's daughter, a skinny-lipped lady with blood like water, who'll give him a peck and call it a kiss, and look in his eyes through a lorgnette. Say, why am I taking on like this? My kid ain't even been born yet. I can see him when he's 17 or so and starting in to go with a girl. I can give him lots of pointers, very sound, on the way to get around any girl. I can tell him.
Wait a minute. Could it be? What the? What if he is a girl? Oh, Bill. Bill. What would I do with her? What could I do for her? A bum with no money.
You can have fun with a son, but you gotta be a father to a girl. She mightn't be so bad at that, a kid with ribbons in her hair.
kind of sweet and petite, little tin type of her mother. What a pair, my little girl, pink and white as peaches and cream is she. Meant to be. Dozens of boys pursue her, many a likely lad does what he can to woo her from her faithful dad. She has a few young fellers of two or three, but my little girl gets hungry every night, and she comes home to me. I gotta get ready before she comes. I gotta make certain that she won't be dragged up in slums with a lot of bums like me. She's gotta be sheltered and fed and dressed in the best that money can buy. I never knew how to get money, but I'll try. I'll go out and make it, or steal it, or take it, or die.
Certainly made a difference between boys and girls in those days. You know, there was this, it was a commercial during the Super Bowl where they said, you know, like throw a ball like a girl, you know, many years ago, and everybody did it sort of effeminately. And now they said to little girls, you know, run like a girl. And this girl took off like a streak, you know, and throw a ball like a girl. And she picked up this ball and she flung it, you know, and fight like a girl. And she just practically knocked.
Was this a commercial?
Yes, it was wonderful because it was a sense that, you know, our image of a little girl being all pink and white and has definitely changed. Though there are lots of little girls who like pink and white. I'm not saying
that. Well, the interesting thing is that the little boys are going to be pink and white too.
Probably.
When they first show up. Anyway, they're pink and white, and
unless they're dark and
that's
pudgy.
True. That's true. That's true.
But you know, remember when our little boys were very well? Actually, our first son was in a playgroup, and there were three little boys, I think, and a girl. And when I would just pick up the little girl, and they were all like practically the same size, she was lighter than the boys. The boys were just physically denser, like they had denser bones than she did. And it was then I realized that there really is a difference between boys and girls. I mean, it's not a difference in a stereotypical way, but it's just like physically there is a difference. And we need to honor the difference as well as not hold anybody back from expressing their particular uniqueness.
And I'm glad you could point this out to us and our listeners, because you may not have noticed that there is, in fact, this difference between boys and girls. It may come as a surprise to many of you. But if you'll take a second look, you'll begin to see the differences show up. You have to be patient because it's not always obvious at first because, you know, they got two arms and two legs and two nostrils and that sort of thing. But if you keep watching and especially listen.
He's making fun of me, but that's okay. I don't mind being made fun of as long as it creates a laugh.
That's
laugh,
part
oh,
of
laugh, the, my son, laugh, laugh, laugh.
Isn't one of the most delightful things to be able to make a child laugh? I had a beautiful little child that lives here at Lupin. Curielle is her name. And she comes up and she just gives me a hug around my legs. And then she was down there between my legs. And I just started doing funny things with my feet and her feet. And she laughed. And there's such an easy audience. And for someone who craves, you know, easy audience, kids, go for kids. If you're coveting, by the way, an easy audience, let me recommend children. It doesn't take much to get them to laugh, especially if you can just do weird things in your body.
And funny faces. Make funny faces. They'll laugh a whole lot. Yes, that's true. But it's wonderful to make a child smile or laugh. There's something about it that is magical. Like these little babies that come into my sight, and I just do things with my fingers or face or smile at them or coo all over them, and they just smile and giggle and gurgle. They don't giggle, they gurgle.
Probably the greatest challenge that any emerging human being has, and that's a lot what our work is about, is how to transform the fear and what to do with the fear and how love can essentially eradicate the fear. But until you reach that time and you get scared, well, maybe you could take this advice.
Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune so no one will suspect I'm afraid. While shivering in my shoes, I strike a careless pose and whistle a happy tune, and no one ever knows I'm afraid. The result of this deception is very strange to tell, for when I fool the people I fear, I fool myself as well. I whistle a happy tune, and every single time, the happiness in the tune convinces me that I'm not afraid. Make believe you're brave, and the trick will take you far. You may be as brave as you make believe you are. You may be as brave as you make believe you are.
I think that's a very good idea, Mother. A very good idea.
Yes, it is a good idea, isn't it?
I don't think I shall ever be afraid again.
Good. The result of this deception is very strange to tell. For when I fool the people I fear, I fool myself as well. I whistle a happy tune, and every single time, the happiness in the tune convinces me that I'm not afraid. Make believe you're brave,
and the trick will take you far.
You may be as brave
as you make believe you are.
You may be as brave as you make believe you are.
Oh, I love that song. It makes me happy every time I hear it.
And of course, that's The King and I, but do you know who the singer was?
It sounds like Julie Harris.
Julie Andrews. It was Julie Andrews. She did an album version with Ben Kingsley.
Oh, wow.
I don't think it was ever performed live, but that's beautiful. And I guess this is a tribute to Rodgers and Hammerstein night because they wrote Carousel and The King and I. And we are so indebted to them for their amazing songs and lyrics.
Especially Hammerstein's lyrics. I find his lyrics are so amazingly aware, very sophisticated in a spiritual sense. I mean, he really seemed to understand the human condition and put it into such beautiful poetry and lyricism.
I want to say something about that song. I think that song should be sung and learned and memorized by every toddler playgroup that there is. And by golly, I'm going to make a commitment tonight. If I'm still around when our little granddaughter is old enough to learn that song, we're going to teach it, and we're going to do it. And it's going to be great, because I think it sets the stage for realizing that you fool yourself as well. And since fear is an illusion that we are served up by duality, if you will, then
whistle a happy tune.
Whistle a happy tune, and you just watch that duality just kind of cower and diminish.
It's another way of saying love the fear.
Exactly. Really? Love the fear. So we are Insight Out, the Naked Truth. We're about to wrap up for tonight. We've just got another minute or so. And tonight we kind of focused on babies because we're expecting a baby. But we got to go. So come back Tuesday night. Check our website, thelaughingheart.org. And remember, we're here on Tuesday night. So.
And if there's anything you'd like us to focus on and turn it into a celebration, just give us a call at errolestrider@gmail.com.
There you go.
Email us. And remember, resistance is what you add to pain to make it last longer and hurt more.
You heard it here, folks.